Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
If you're like most Americans, you've been groggy all day after losing an hour of sleep to daylight saving. And as you struggle to remember how to change the clock on your f***ing microwave, you may have wondered, why is this happening?
Studies show there is an increase of car accidents and work-related injuries the week after the time change.
That's right. What you lose in sleep, you gain in mortal danger. Despite all this, 70 countries around the world still observe daylight saving. It has to make you wonder, daylight saving time, how is this still a thing?
That's Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, asking the question many of us were asking as we dragged ourselves out of bed this morning. And while we struggle to readjust our sleep schedules, it's worth noting just how detrimental even a little less sleep can be. One study released last week found that losing just 30 minutes of sleep each day boosted the risk of diabetes by 17%. And that's in line with a growing body of research that links sleep debt to obesity and diabetes. Dr. Ezra Tesali studies sleep and sleep disorders at the University of Chicago Medicine, and she's here now. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, the finding I mentioned just now that just a half hour less sleep a night can have a 17% increase in diabetes risk. Does that surprise you?
Not really, actually. There is a large set of epidemiologic data, as you mentioned, that links sleep restriction or short sleep duration, particularly 6 hours or less, or sometimes less than 6.5 hours, with obesity and diabetes. The originality of this study is that, as you mentioned, as little as 30 minutes can also increase this risk. And prior studies were looking into an hour difference, an hour and a half difference. Yeah.
And is that long term, or does it take just a week of that kind of sleep deprivation to increase your risk?
Right. In most of these epidemiologic studies, it's the self-reported sleep duration, and this particular study evaluated at baseline and then 6 months later the individual. So this is basically representing their self-reported habitual sleep. So it's probably over a long term, but the majority of the laboratory studies were short term, looking at anywhere from one night to 3 weeks duration. But as short as a couple of nights can still increase the risk for diabetes or show signs of diabetes in your testing.
Wow. And so what is the hypothesis behind that?
Basically, when you're sleep deprived, there are other hormonal changes in the body. For example, the hormone adrenaline goes up, what we call a sympathetic activity. The body is secreting these hormones, and that can create what we call insulin resistance. The hormone that regulates your blood sugar does not do its job properly because of all these other stimulus. And you're not disposing as much glucose or sugar to your tissues, and you become sort of in a pre-diabetic state.
Wow. And so this is happening when you're awake, that you're secreting these hormones, or is it when you're sleeping?
Is it when you're forcing yourself to be awake,
right?
Meaning when you're sleep depriving yourself, correct? Yes. Normally, norepinephrine or adrenaline is very low during the nighttime and then increases during the day or when you're awake.
So this is also causing increased obesity, correct?
Correct. Yes. Yes.
And so is there any kind of hypothesis saying, look, we have an obesity crisis in our country, and maybe that tracks with loss of sleep?
Yes, there are lots of hypotheses and lots of research going on in this area. There is clearly a link from epidemiologic studies associating short sleep with obesity risk. The laboratory studies looked into a couple of the mechanisms, and one thing that comes out systematically is that if someone's sleep deprived, either in the laboratory or even in the field, they tend to crave for more energy-dense foods, carbohydrate, or what we call junk food, and that can be one of the explanations. The increased appetite could be one of the explanations for weight gain. Some of the other studies also looked at the changes in the brain, and those studies also show that brain regions that regulate the appetite act differently when you're sleep deprived versus you're fully rested. So research is still ongoing there to better understand.
So that would come from overeating or eating the wrong foods, but not necessarily from changes in your metabolic function from lack of sleep.
Correct. Most of the studies did not find so far changes in energy expenditure. There are a few studies that looked at in the field to first degree relatives of type 2 diabetics. For example, they show more sedentary activities if they're short sleepers. So if they're sleeping less than 6 hours, they tend to also do less activity. But those studies are small in numbers. So generally speaking, it's more overeating than changing the activity.
Well, I'm wondering if you can catch up on the weekend and reverse all these changes.
This is an excellent question, and many people are wondering about this. There are some studies from the laboratory, what we call a recovery sleep. These have been done on more of a longer term in terms of 4 nights or 7 nights. I don't think there are any studies that evaluated recovery within very short, sort of a mimicking the weekend after 2 nights. But the more longer-term studies shows that good news is there is recovery. Mm-hmm. So the recommendation definitely would be try to get as much sleep as you can or catch up on your sleep on the weekends, for sure.
Okay, I guess we'll all be doing that after the daylight saving time works its way through us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Esra Tasali. She studies sleep disorders at the University of Chicago Medicine. And we'd love to hear from you about how you're dealing with daylight saving time. If you feel like you are incredibly sleep deprived and what it does to you, give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or hit us on Facebook at KCRWPressPlay. If one of the things that's been keeping you up at night is your credit score, there's a little good news today. A bad credit score, whether it's accurate or not, can stand between you and, let's say, buying a house or even getting a job. Now, the three big companies have agreed to make it easier for consumers to fix bad credit information. Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion negotiated for a year with New York's Attorney General on the change. And to talk about it, we're joined now by Liz Pulliam-Weston. She writes about personal finance at AskLizWeston.com. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Madeline.
All right. So these new rules, what are they and how do they come about?
Well, this is, as you said, an agreement with the New York Attorney General. And basically what the credit bureaus have agreed to do is, one, to hold off a bit on reporting medical debt. And that's a huge deal. The other thing they're going to do is have human beings review disputes, another big deal, because so often this is a very automated process. You try to dispute something, the lender says it's correct, and you're just stuck. Nobody will intervene for you to make a difference. So hopefully this will help people who have those kind of ongoing disputes or errors that repeatedly show up. Hopefully this will help them get a resolution to their problem.
So before this, there weren't actual real human beings handling your issues, your questions about your credit report?
Well, there was a human being that would put a code onto your dispute to kind of tell the lender what it was about. But no, there wasn't somebody reviewing the information that you sent in or looking at, you know, what your previous history was to try to weigh who was right, who was wrong. They really didn't serve as, you know, the middleman or the arbitrators. Basically, they just turned it over to the lender and said, is this correct? If the lender said, yeah, this is correct, that was kind of it. You know, a lot of people wound up going to the courts to try to resolve these long-standing issues that they had an error in their credit report. Everybody agreed it was an error, but they couldn't get rid of it.
And how many people have errors in their reports?
You know, there's different studies that try to come up with an answer to that. I mean, some I've seen have said about 1 in 5, 1 in 4, something like that. The issue is, how serious are those errors? Because if they just have an old employer listed, that's not affecting your credit score at all. If they have confused you with someone else, if there are, you know, collections and late payments on your account when you paid on time, or if you're alive and the credit bureaus are saying you're dead, that's another big issue that can be a problem, because you can't get credit if the credit bureaus say that you're not alive.
Well, how did we get to this point where just these three agencies, these three companies, have control over so many people's financial futures?
It is interesting how much sway the credit bureaus have. I think a lot of people underestimate the fact that, you know, it's not just whether you get a loan and what interest rate you pay. It's landlords use credit scores. Employers tend to use credit reports rather than credit scores, but they're still looking at your credit. You know, what kind of utility deposit you have to pay. All this is relying on your credit reports. And basically, it's, you know, just a few companies have the bulk of this information. I don't know if people understand how prevalent it is, but that's the reality. And if you don't pay attention to your credit and to your credit reports, you're going to have trouble. You're going to pay a lot more money or have difficulty getting services that could be easy otherwise.
Right. And so, and if you do have a problem, though, it takes, what, 7 years to clear up some bad credit?
Well, it takes 7 years for most negative information to fall off your credit report. There's a few things that can stay on there forever, like unpaid tax liens, for example. And a bankruptcy will stay on there for 10 years. But most stuff will fall off after 7 years. Still, that's a long time to wait. That's a long time to be in credit purgatory.
Yeah.
And you don't want to have that, you know, messing with your ability to take care of business.
And why 7 years? It seems like an arbitrary figure.
It does seem like an arbitrary figure, doesn't it? That's part of the federal, the Fair Credit Reporting Act that's been revised a few times over the years, just to kind of keep people from being in a debtor's prison. You know, they didn't want it to go on forever, that one misstep that you made in your youth would follow you into old age. So they had to put some limit on it. I'm actually not sure why they came up with 7 years, but that's a good question.
Mm. Right. And so a lot of people had their credit scores docked during the Great Recession. You know, maybe they lost their home or their job or what have you, and their credit scores declined, and perhaps they've recovered somewhat, and yet they still have bad credit. Is there any hope for them, or do they really have to wait 7 years?
Well, actually, your credit scores can start improving as soon as the bad stuff stops. So if the bankruptcy, if the foreclosure, if whatever it was, if that's in the past and you start using credit responsibly, your scores will actually start to improve fairly quickly. Now, you won't get back to you were, you know, for quite some time. The better your score, the harder it is to regain it. It's like a mountain. You know, the higher up you climb, the farther you have to fall and the harder it is to get back up there. So that when we say 7 years, we mean until, you know, you no longer see that effect on your credit scores. If you had low scores to begin with, maybe in 3 years, you know, you get back to where you were. But the higher your score, the longer it takes to recover.
Now, these companies generate billions of dollars a year in revenue. They are fined repeatedly by states. They lose lawsuits. And it doesn't seem to change their behavior very much. How much do you expect these new rules or this settlement with the New York Attorney General to really substantively change things?
Well, you asked a question earlier that about, you know, how we came to this point, how we got to the state where these three companies had so much control over our financial lives. And the reason that they do is because this system works really well for lenders. You know, the lenders report their information, they get back information on you. If they make a mistake on an individual, well, that's no big deal to them, you know, because they got plenty of other people to deal with to make money from. So they haven't been really attuned to fixing errors, fixing mistakes, because it was just considered a cost of business. I think this change, these changes, will really make a difference, because now we have actual human beings on the front lines looking at these disputes. Now, it's going to depend on how they roll it out, how they execute, of course. But just having a human being involved is a big deal. That's a big change. And when you get to the other side, to the medical collections, this is an increasing problem. And people that, you know, have good credit, that take care of their finances, you know, they might not track a single medical bill, it falls through the cracks, their insurer doesn't pay it, all of a sudden their credit scores are trashed because of this. And that's increasingly common. So the fact that these two areas have been, you know, the focus of this agreement, I think will make a big difference in people's lives.
All right. Well, we'll see. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Liz Pulliam-Weston writes about personal finance at AskLizWeston.com. And we'd like to hear from you if you've had a credit report nightmare. And do you think the agreement's going to make any difference? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, and we may use your comment on the air at the end of the show. Coming up, a new deal between HBO and Apple TV, and a new look behind the scenes at NBC in the wake of the Brian Williams scandal. All that ahead on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. New details today about how the Brian Williams situation exploded at NBC. According to New York Magazine, when Williams' stories about being shot down in Iraq were shot down, they also exposed a news division that was already in crisis mode, already in trouble. Joining us to talk about that and other things TV, Michael Schneider, executive editor for TV Guide Magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff.
Hello, Madeline.
And joining us today for her first outing on the show, Kate Arthur, Chief Los Angeles Correspondent for BuzzFeed News.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming in. Well, let's begin not with that, but with the news that came out at the big Apple event today that it's partnering with HBO to provide exclusive streaming service.
Yeah, this is a big coup for Apple. Obviously, we've been waiting for the big announcement of HBO Now, which is their standalone streaming service, and the fact that for the first 3 months it'll be exclusive on Apple devices. It's big for Apple.
And big for HBO?
Huge for HBO. People have been waiting for this to happen, and people were also wondering whether they could get it together to do it before Game of Thrones, their big April premiere. And yes, that is in fact what's happening.
So what's happening is it'll be $15 a month to have all of HBO. You don't have to buy the rest of cable. And for the first 3 months, you get it only on Apple.
Yeah, and I think the hope at HBO is that there are a lot of people who are already pirating the HBO Go service. They're using their parents' login accounts, and they're basically never going to pay for HBO anyway. So maybe now, if they buy it as a standalone, they will, and HBO will make some extra cash.
Okay, let's move on to Brian Williams, the juicy stuff. And this article was full of tantalizing tidbits. What did you make of it, Kate?
I couldn't believe it. It was just, it revealed just what a huge mess things are at NBC News that led up to his temporary or perhaps permanent ouster. And just, it just seems like a toxic, toxic place. And that's been true at the network for a long time. But NBC News itself is just falling apart.
It's a reminder that the chaos began a couple years earlier with the mess on the Today Show, the Ann Curry debacle, and then the mess in replacing the Meet the Press host. And there have been several stumbles in the past couple of years and a lot of chaos in the top with management bringing in a new producer for the Today Show, which was a debacle, and all of that sort of setting the stage for this Brian Williams mess, the one show that actually was working for NBC News, well, not so much. And then they made plenty of missteps with that now, too.
So now they brought in Andrew Lack, who was the one who cultivated Brian Williams in the first place, right? Made him a star.
Right. This has made people think that Brian Williams might actually come back, which people were thinking might not be the case if Lester Holt does well in the anchor seat, which he has been doing. But Andrew Lack was a champion of Brian Williams and is his friend and was advising him before he was brought in. So,
yeah,
you know, he might actually return.
He could. And then you never know with Andrew Lack. He's also the man who came in 1993 and took over NBC News after the big Dateline NBC debacle when they were discovered to blow up cars on camera. And you know, several heads rolled there, too. So I think Andy Lack's job, number one, is to bring back credibility to NBC. And also he's got his own credibility on the line coming back to try to save the news division. So if they decide it's just not going to work for Brian Williams, he may still let him go.
Well, speaking of credibility, one of the most jaw-dropping points in this article to me was that Brian Williams apparently was not a fan of investigative news and spiked several stories that became big stories, stories brought by investigative journalist Michael Isikoff of Monica Lewinsky fame and Lisa Myers, who's a longtime investigative journalist for NBC News. He seemed not interested in these stories that they brought him.
Right. Well, it seems like he wasn't interested in things that might rock the boat. This was true of he didn't want to be anti-military either, and that was one of the things that came out in the Iraq scandal, just that he was kind of catering to all of these interests that thought that it would make him, you know, boost his popularity.
It also reveals the cult of personality surrounding these anchors, the fact that they've been given these managing editor titles and probably too much power. And what was interesting in the story was that there aren't a lot of supporters inside NBC News for Brian Williams, specifically because they felt that he had too much power, too much say, and was not necessarily doing things for the better of the newscast.
And that he wasn't even interested in the news that much, that he really, his heart really was in late night television, and he really, really wanted to be the successor to either Jay Leno or David Letterman.
Yeah, he wanted to slow jam the news every night of the week, apparently.
Wow. Okay, so let's move on from NBC to ABC, a new drama called American Crime. And let's hear a clip from the first episode. This is Felicity Huffman and Timothy Hutton. They've just found out that their son has been murdered.
You gambled away everything we had, then you went and stole so you could gamble some more.
It was an illness, Bart. It was an addiction, and I got myself help, and now I am recovered.
We had nothing raising those boys by myself in public housing. Do you have any idea what that was like? Huh? A white mother and her two white kids. Do you know what those people did to us day after day? Do you know how those people treated my boys? I am here trying to do what I can for Matt. And your feelings are hurt over what I say to reporters.
Barb, come on.
Stop saying my name.
Wow, Felicity Huffman, what a performance it sounds like. So, and it also sounds like this goes far beyond the basic police procedural.
Yeah, I mean, it's so far been a really gritty cable drama that's on ABC at 10 p.m. on Thursday nights. It did pretty well. It was created by John Ridley, who won the Oscar for the screenwriting 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I found it to be almost hard to watch because of how harsh it is. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I thought Timothy Hutton's portrayal of the grieving father was probably the strongest part in the first episode. You know, what's the cliche right now is everything you sort of compare to Serial, the podcast.
Oh,
and of course,
yeah.
This is sort of the scripted drama version of Serial, the podcast, where there's a murder mystery at the center of it. And you're slowly pulling back the onion, who may be guilty, who may not be guilty, who may be wrongfully arrested, etc. It's so similar to Serial, as a matter of fact, that ABC is launching a podcast about the show, by the way, hosted
really?
By KCRW's own Elvis Mitchell.
Oh, okay.
So it all comes full circle.
Well, also, John Ridley is on Morning Edition.
So,
you know, as a special correspondent from time to time.
So there you go. It all
it's
comes
all
around.
One big, happy American family. All right. So one more show, sort of in the police procedural vein, CSI Cyber. How many CSIs are there now?
Well, there are only two now. There's The Mothership, which actually finished its season recently. And now this is the second one. Miami and New York are no longer with us. So
they're attempting to reboot the CSI franchise. But Anthony Zeiker, who actually created the whole franchise, is really running the ship on this one. And it goes a little different direction than the other CSIs, which were straight ahead crime procedurals. These all sort of have a cyber element to it. And of course, the timing is sort of great because it's such a hot topic with the Sony hack and everything else going on right now. But it's still a procedural. It's still CBS meat and potatoes.
Although, can I say that watching people type on computers and code is not that exciting?
It never is. So. No one's figured it out. It could be called CSI FBI if that weren't too many letters.
Yeah, too many letters. But yeah, so it's basically the mothership CSI probably has 1 or 2 years left in it. So this is a way to sort of keep the franchise going, but with a little bit of a spin.
With Patricia Arquette, who just won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress.
There you go. So again, the Oscar theme going through here. Oscar winners go to TV. That's where the work is.
But couldn't she get something a little more marquee now that she's won this?
Well, she had signed up for this before she won the Oscar.
Uh-huh.
But I actually interviewed her last week, and she she loves being on television. She really appreciates network television. She made her career in independent film and loved being in Boyhood, but thinks that what has paid her bills is being on Medium, yeah. And now this.
Well, I was going to say, I think more Americans saw her on Medium than they yeah. ever did on Boyhood or some of her other indie films.
Right.
So there's still much better roles, especially for actresses on television than there are in film.
Well, thank you both very much.
Sure.
Thanks a lot.
Kate Arthur is Chief Los Angeles Correspondent for BuzzFeed News, and Michael Schneider, Executive Editor for TV Guide Magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Coming up on the show, a black farmer in South LA grows weed and watermelons and has a slave named Hominy. That's the protagonist in Paul Beatty's new novel, a satire called The Sellout. My conversation with Paul Beatty after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Paul Beatty's new novel is an acerbic and absurdist look at what it means to be black in America. It's called The Sellout, and it's laced with cutting insights about race, slavery, Oreo cookies, and segregation. It's set here in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles must have racism vortexes, spots where visitors experience deep feelings of melancholy and ethnic worthlessness. Places like the breakdown lane on the Foothill Freeway, where Rodney King's life, and in a sense, America and its haughty notions of fair play, began their downward spirals. Racial vortices like the intersection of Florence and Normandy, where misbegotten trucker Reginald Denny caught a cinder block, a 40-ounce, and centuries of frustration to the face. Chavez Ravine, where a generations-old Mexican-American neighborhood was torn down, its residents forcibly removed, beaten, and left uncompensated to make room for a baseball stadium with ample parking and the Dodger dog.
And Paul Beatty joins me now to talk about The Sellout. Welcome.
Thank you.
I think that was one of the rare, really serious passages of your novel. Because, you know, most of it, although it has these insights into race and that really, you know, that some of them take your breath away, they are couched in a lot of humor.
It's not like I'm trying to make it funny. It's just how I write. You know, I'm trying to kind of write something I want to read a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I just crack jokes and I try to have fun with it. You know, in a weird way, it's all really, really serious, you know. But the humor is just, it's just how I communicate, I guess.
Okay, well, let's talk about your main character. He's black and his name is Bon Bon, and he is, the book opens, he has been summoned to the U.S. Supreme Court to explain himself because he's been charged with becoming a slave owner, reinstituting slavery, and segregating a school in South Los Angeles. So tell us a bit more about this character, Bon Bon. Who is he?
I guess his father has raised him to be... there's a part in the book where his father says he's going to be kind of one of these Renaissance niggas. I don't know. Can I say that?
Yeah, guess. Too late now. Yeah, why not?
I don't know. I don't want to speak for anybody else. But when I was young, there's a lot of pressure of people like sculpting you and chipping at you to try to make you this very presentable idea of what they feel like a black male should be, like a black person should be. And his father is... You know, as a social psychologist, is really interested in that. And so he's kind of groomed, he's homeschooled and experimented upon, you know, to kind of be this kind of ideal black kid.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes and it doesn't take, you know, a little bit of a Frankenstein's monster type thing, I guess.
Yeah. And he also embraces and then completely subverts these African-American stereotypes.
Yeah.
Right? So he actually is a watermelon farmer. But he grows square watermelons.
He grows really good watermelon, actually,
really good
also.
Ones. But, yeah, delicious. And he's a surfer, and he admits to being terrible in bed. And then he's part of this group of black intellectuals called the Dum Dum Club.
The Dum Dum Donut Intellectuals.
The Dum Dum Donut Intellectuals. So it's a group of men his father used to hang out with in the donut shop.
Yeah.
So Dum Dum, and it's an intellectual. I get that. It's a group of intellectuals, and he doesn't really speak that much as he's in this group. And what is it that actually gets him to start talking?
What gets him to start talking? Well, he's a reluctant member. He kind of feels he's kind of there because his father started it, and yeah, feels a little bit of guilt and burn about carrying on the legacy a little bit. So he shows up. But he kind of comes up with the notion of kind of refounding the town where he's from, which is called Dickens, California. And so, you know, he wants to do it in a sort of formal way. So he feels the need to make an announcement to the Dum Dum intellectuals, which is like composed of people who live in the town and people who don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so he shows up and he actually finally has something to say.
And he wants to bring back Dickens because Dickens, for some reason, has been erased. And
yeah.
No one knows why.
And kind of as an embarrassment, I think, to the state.
So they've just gotten rid of all the signs that say "Welcome to Dickens." It's just it's just another formless area of streets and stop signs and donut shops. And Dickens, why did you name it Dickens?
For me, I guess it's, I don't want to say obvious necessarily, but, you know, Dickens, you know, his work is a large part about class and exploitation and poverty and bleakness and all these kind of things. And it's unflinching.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's, you know, it's part of that. It's also the people who founded Compton. You know, there's a school in Compton called Dickinson. And, you know, so yeah, it's a play on a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so one part I like about, you know, being from L.A., I kind of caught on to this, that he looks in the Thomas Guide and he loves the Thomas Guide.
Yeah.
Which, I guess, you know, you have to be of a certain age, I guess, to know even what we're talking about. But
maybe so.
And you definitely have to be from Los Angeles. But this is a book that was in every car in Los Angeles until, I guess, map apps came out. And it's Los Angeles, greater Los Angeles. And he goes to find Dickens or his neighborhood, and it's sort of this document page in the Thomas Guide. And then when he really looks, he's disappointed at what he sees.
I, too, love the Thomas Guide and still own one.
You own one even though you live in New York?
Yeah. I mean, I look at it all the time. I mean, you know, if something comes up, I don't really look on the map. I try to find it in the Thomas Guide.
Yeah. But what I found really interesting about you putting in the Thomas Guide and this idea of trying to find your place in it and then maybe just finding it and it looks kind of generic and boring, but also this idea of erasure of place and identity as being something that is intimately tied up with the experience that your character deals with, and by extension that a lot of African Americans deal with, this idea of erasing where you came from.
Yeah. So the erasure is kind of like a, you know, the other side of the coin, like the obverse of what's happening, at least, you know, from my perspective, to a lot of neighborhoods in L.A., which like every 3 square blocks is a neighborhood now in L.A. So there's all these lines being drawn. To me, the idea of it was interesting where those lines are being drawn and where those lines aren't being drawn, you know, in terms of L.A. County. And I just got fascinated with the idea of just erasing these little blights. Like, in, you know, one way to say, oh, this is, you know, the most violent city in the world is let's just get rid of the city, you know, not necessarily the people or the structures, but let's just get rid of the concept of this place. You know, I just really that idea really struck me.
And then there's another part, another interesting illustration where you describe how people differentiate themselves from other people in Los Angeles, and that's through their modes of transportation, because it's all about negotiating space here in Los Angeles, and you really define yourself as to how you negotiate that space. And I love the taxonomy of the different modes of transportation, and you put being on the bus at the very bottom.
Yeah.
I mean, below walking.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. I mean, I can't speak for now, but when I took the bus, depending on what line you were, it could be traumatic. Who would see you? What would happen on the bus? And, you know, it was the RTD, which people used to call the rough, tough, and dangerous. And, yeah, it was an experience riding the bus.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Paul Beatty. He has a new novel out. It's called The Sellout. And The Sellout is what your main character is called by another guy, one of the dum-dum donut intellectuals. And why does he call Bon Bon the sellout?
I mean, I guess is you know, Bon Bon at some level embraces all the things that, you know, a sane, modern-day black person shouldn't embrace. You know, like we talked about earlier, he grows watermelon, he grows marijuana, he likes the black characters on The Little Rascals. you know, he does all the things that are supposed to be setting black people back 500 years. And, you know, I mean, you hear that a lot. You know, you've set the race back X number of years. You know, usually it's 400 or 500. And those are, a lot of those things are things that Bon Bon has at least an appreciation for.
So you mentioned The Little Rascals, and that's at the heart of his appearance at the Supreme Court because he's charged or he's accused of reinstituting slavery in the case of one little rascal named Hominy Jenkins, who was he was basically an understudy for Buckwheat. Is that right?
Yeah, he was Buckwheat's understudy. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But he didn't enslave Hominy. Hominy asked to be enslaved.
Hominy has a, you know, having been who he was, he's got a slight masochistic tendency to him, I guess. And it's just this notion of punishment for what, why, to what extent do we still punish ourselves, you know, and to what extent do we feel guilty? What do we feel guilty about? And it's a big part of the book. I mean, there's a passage in there about black guilt, like how people don't talk about black guilt. You know, you hear about like white guilt and other kind of guilts, but no one talks about black guilt. The narrator talks about, yeah, you know, the only time where he doesn't feel guilty is when he's actually committed a crime, you know, because he's finally unburdened from this constraint of having to act a certain way, having to talk a certain way, having to do all these things. And that's finally gone, you know. Yeah, and Hominy is an embodiment of a ton of stuff, but, you know, that's part of it.
He has a really tortured relationship with his girlfriend. Well, his on-again-off-again girlfriend, Marpessa. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
Marpessa. She calls him a race pervert.
Yeah. Well, he kind of is, I guess.
Well, what does that mean, a race pervert?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we all have a sense of what, you know, a perversion is. And he's kind of perverted about race. You know, he's kind of like a peeping Tom, you know, about race, just digging, pulling the curtains, spying and confronting the taboos about race. And, you know, he's just really open about it in a weird way and comfortable with it and not ashamed of the past, I think. And but it's in a weird way, it's, you know, it's really discomforting for her and for some other people in the book, I guess. And so she just terms it as a perversion, you know, because she's not comfortable with it.
Okay, so Dickens, why was it important to bring it back?
Well, he kind of doesn't bring it back so much for himself, at least at the start. He brings it back because Hominy has lost his sense of place, and so is the main character. I don't know how aware of it is. He's aware of it, I guess. But, you know, he's lost his sense of place. It's, you know, he's not from anywhere all of a sudden. And Hominy's the only reason that anybody from outside of Dickens ever goes to Dickens, because people come, you know, because he's the last living little rascal, so he's got a small fan base, and occasionally people would come find him and say, hey, you know, sign this, sign that. And so that happens, like, after Dickens gets arrest, you know, that stops. And it's just that sense of, you know, you lose a part of yourself. I mean, think about it. Like, if where you're from disappeared, it's like when your parents move from the house that you grew up in, you know, and you go, oh, you know, where am I from? Where do I live? Where do I go back to? So I think he needs that grounding, you know. And he realizes that a lot of the other people in the community need that grounding. You know, there's losing that sense of place has really changed the way that people behave.
Okay, so people, you know, people who read this book, do you want them to come away with something in particular in terms of, I don't know, anything? Do you want what kind of?
No, I want them. That's a good question, but it's a question I can't really answer. You know, it's always nice when people feel like they've learned something or been somewhere, you know, that they haven't thought of before. Or it's like, you know, when a comedian tells a really good joke and you go, man, she beat me to it. That's what I always think. Why didn't I ever say that? And I always kind of like that feeling in a weird way. I'm sure that there will be people who don't like the book because there are things in there that might make them uncomfortable, might embarrass them for whatever reason, you know. But I can't worry about that, you know.
The book is called The Sellout. It's by Paul Beatty. Paul Beatty, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Warren Olney is in as well. Hello.
I am indeed. Hello.
Happy
nice
Monday.
To see you. Thank you. Happy Monday to you as well. We're going to be talking today, taking off from the Justice Department report on Ferguson, about relations between black people and the police in the United States, and particularly in Ferguson and that neighborhood, which it turns out is not all that uncommon, where the whole judicial system is actually designed to take advantage of poor people, to take money from them, mm-hmm. and finance the justice system with it. It's an extortion racket. Very, very disturbing. And we'll hear about that and how widespread this kind of behavior still is. We know, of course, a lot about that here in Los Angeles, where the LAPD was once described as an occupying army. And we have the consent decree, and some mm-hmm. changes were made. Whether there were enough or not, we have yet to know.
All right. Look forward to that very timely conversation at 1 o'clock. To the Point and Warren Olney. Thank you.
Okay.
And coming up on this program right before that, the latest pictures of young mountain lions in the Santa Monica Mountains have raised new concerns about where they'll live as older lions fight for their territory. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There are new pictures of mountain lions here in the Santa Monica Mountains. Rangers set up a remote camera near a deer kill, and they captured graphic close-ups of a mother and two of her sleek, tawny, 15-month-old cubs feeding on the carcass. One of the kittens stands staring straight into the camera. Older lions have already staked a claim to all the Santa Monica Mountains territory, so the younger ones don't have their own territory, and sometimes they're killed crossing the 101 and 405 freeways trying to find new places to roam. Seth Riley is a wildlife ecologist with the National Park Service in the Santa Monica Mountains, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what did you think when you saw those pictures?
Well, it's pretty amazing to get photos like that. You know, these animals, all the animals we study really are pretty elusive. We basically never see them. So it's pretty cool to see some of that behavior. I mean, we know that they're hunting and killing deer. That's their main prey, but it's pretty cool to get photos like that. Jeff Sikich, who's our main field biologist on the Lion Project, has worked with National Geographic, and we've ended up with some really amazing cameras, which are what he was using there.
Right. So there's a tripwire or something like that, and
exactly. Yeah, those are remote photos, and usually a lot of the remote cameras we use, we're trying to get photos of animals crossing under freeways and things like that, so they're not as high quality as those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those are pretty great.
So they don't know their picture is being taken, I guess, because when they're looking into the camera, they're not really seeing a camera.
Well, those ones do, to get that kind of quality, they do have a flash.
Mm.
If we're trying to be very covert, we don't use the flash. But those ones do, but obviously they didn't seem to be too bothered by it.
No, no. All right, so that was a picture of a mom and her two cubs. How many mountain lions are in the Santa Monica Mountains?
Well, we never know exactly how many, although we're tracking quite a few right now. We're actually tracking P13, an adult female, and then her daughter, P19, who's the mother there in those photos. And then we're tracking actually all three of P19's subadult offspring, the ones, two of which are in the pictures. And then we're tracking another daughter of P19, P23. So that's three adult females plus three subadults. And then we're also tracking an adult male, P27, who lives in the east end of the Santa Monicas, east of Malibu Canyon. So that's seven there. There are certainly animals that we're not radio tracking. But the challenge is there really isn't room, and this is what we've seen over the 12 years of our study, there really isn't room for more than about 10, maybe a few more than that if you want to be generous, 10 adult mountain lions in the Santa Monica Mountains. You know, regularly adult males use the entire mountain range. Maybe sometimes, like right now, it seems like there's two males splitting it, but either way. And then you might have a few females you know, we're following three right now. Maybe there's a couple more, but that's five females and two males, you know. So in terms of adults, there's just not space for very many, which is a problem genetically and demographically.
Right. So there's a lot of inbreeding going on.
Well, yes, more than you'd like to see. And unfortunately, for example, this litter is the result of P19 mating with P12, who's also her father. And this is the third instance that we've documented of that. But it's so difficult because the Santa Monica Mountains are cut off by the freeway and development for any animals to disperse in or out. And so we think that makes these inbreeding events more likely. And in fact, work we've done with UCLA and UC Davis on the genetics, we've seen that there's significantly lower genetic diversity in the Santa Monica Mountains than to the north, than basically than anywhere else in California, and actually than anywhere else throughout the West where mountain lions have been studied.
Hmm. So what happens to the lions themselves after all this inbreeding?
Well, in the long run, it can be a serious issue. So mountain lions in Florida, which are called Florida panthers and are on the endangered species list, by the mid-90s, that's the only population that's actually been documented with lower genetic diversity than what we've seen. And they had serious inbreeding issues, actual genetic defects. So there were holes in the heart, atrial septa. There were major disease issues. There was low reproduction. They had like males, one or both testes didn't descend on lots of them. And if both don't descend, then they're sterile. So they were having major issues. We have not yet seen those kinds of issues, fortunately, yet in our population. And so that's why we're really hoping to increase connectivity and get animals moving back and forth between the Santa Monicas and other areas so that we don't get there.
And one of the reasons why there's so little movement is because of those freeways, that when animals try to cross those freeways, they get hit and die.
Yes, and actually with a big freeway like 101, we see a little bit of mortality, but it's almost more of an issue that it's such a big barrier they don't even try. And then that leads to, we think, issues like the increased chances of inbreeding and also increased interactions between animals that are not breeding interactions, but actually aggressive interactions where adult males kill other young animals or young males, even young females, and even in one case, an adult female, which is pretty unusual.
Is it possible to introduce mountain lions from other places?
It is, yeah. And that's something we certainly have thought about. Our goal is to not have to do that. That's sort of more intensive manipulation than we'd prefer to do. So our hope is we can maintain and even increase the amount of connectivity across the freeway so that we don't have to do that. Typically, when you move animals around, they don't do well, you know. So in Florida, it was very effective. They moved 8 female mountain lions from Texas and 5 of them bred, and it totally solved the genetic issues, basically, and the population is much bigger and doing much better, et cetera. But it's a riskier thing, and so we'd prefer to not have to do that.
Right. And so the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy is trying to raise money to build this mountain lion pass over the 101?
Yeah. So there's a bunch of us that have been working together in partnership. So us with the National Park Service, the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy, and Caltrans, of course, is a critical partner in all that. The Resource Conservation District of the Santa Monica Mountains. And actually, the National Wildlife Federation on a national level has been interested in this. So we are really trying to get some kind of crossing, ideally an overpass over 101. There's almost nowhere left along 101 where there's natural habitat up to the freeway on either side, let alone on both sides. So there just aren't that many options left. Mm. And so really probably about the only place that's good is in the Agoura Hills area in Liberty Canyon. And so we've been working for many years to try to preserve habitat on both sides as much as we can. You know, there's, of course, constant pressure on areas in the Santa Monica Mountains and Simi Hills for development, et cetera. So, but we do have natural areas pretty much on both sides there, and so that's where we're really trying to get the crossing.
So people shouldn't be afraid of them, right? I mean, they're not going to attack people. They're nocturnal, and people rarely see them.
Yes, it's true. Yeah, so we've studied 35 plus mountain lions now over 12 years, and knock on wood, we've never had a single instance where they've behaved aggressively. The vast majority of the time, they stay out of people's way, and even P-22 living in Griffith Park is doing that. So yes, so fortunately for everyone, the lions and us, they stay out of people's way, and they're not entirely nocturnal. They can be moving around during the day, but often they move farther and are more active at night.
Seth Riley is a wildlife ecologist with the National Park Service in the Santa Monica Mountains. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
P-22.
Yeah.
I just wish they had, I don't know, more lyrical sounding names.
Yeah, like why isn't it named, I don't know, Unicorn or Harold or Grover Cleveland or...
the list could go on and on.
Or Chappie.
Or Jolie Myers.
Or Jolie Myers, yeah. I have a sizable donation for you, Santa Monica Conservancy. It actually literally has my name on it, if you name the cougar. Also, CSI... CSI Cougar.
Oh, hello.
That's where
that
they should go
the
next
one.
I'm thinking so. I would watch that. I would watch that so hard.
Would the cougar be a crime solver?
Or would it be solving crimes committed by cougars?
I don't know.
The furry
the possibilities
kind
are endless.
People. Get your mind out of the gutter. We asked our listeners about the next CSI. Time Lord Alex tweets that he'd watch CSI Mars, set in the future.
Oh,
I would entertain that. Lee Harvey tweets that CSI Strip Mall would be fun, which I think is already called Better Call Saul. if only CSI could capture that same magic. Gary says CSI Costco parking lot would be relatable because whoever designed those parking lots should be arrested. And Plutonic Pam tweets that CSI should look into doing CSI Frozen, the musical. Worked for Disney, didn't it? That would be a cash grab. That's even a little bit too cynical, even for me. The
right.
Font of press play cynicism.
And there's endless supplies of that as well. All right.
Jolie, renewable energy.
Jolie Myers, thank you very much for that.
Of course.
And if you want to weigh in on anything you've heard on the show, we welcome it. No cynicism here. Facebook, KCRW Press Play, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney and To The Point is up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.